I'm going to start our time out with something you may have never heard a pastor say. You might be getting used to that by now, so maybe those words lose some impact. But as I was preparing for this message, I realized something about just my life and just kind of how I respond to things, and I realized that I need to party more. I don't party enough. Now, strip away the negative connotation that partying has when someone walks into work on a Monday morning and says, I partied a little too hard this weekend, and that has a certain understanding to it. But when I talk about partying, I mean celebration. I mean truly being thankful and grateful. I remember growing up, and I think I've always been kind of like this, because I remember even being like 12 years old at a middle school New Year's Eve party. There's nothing cooler than that. And so we were sitting around, and everything was kind of going on, and they were just getting to the part where we're starting to count down. And at this particular party, the group wanted to count down from a minute, so that's always fun. You know, 59, it's just all over the place, and finally get on track towards the final, you know, few. But I kind of excused myself from all of the shenanigans, kind of found a quiet spot and just sat down and just kind of started reflecting on the year. I mean, I remember this like it was yesterday. It was just really strange how I felt this need to think back on the year and the good and the bad and the ugly, and kind of just saw the flipping over of the calendar as a chance to kind of start fresh and start new. Or maybe for birthdays, you know, again, when birthdays come around, I kind of tend to look at them like, wow, you know, so for me, I've got a birthday coming up in January. Angela's birthday is Friday of this week, which is very exciting. So, you know, for me, when I view that time is coming, the new birthday, I tend to look back a lot and think about, you know, kind of what has happened and what's been done, but I tend to kind of view it almost like, oh, the mistakes that I made or the things I want to do differently or, you know, maybe some making some new promises for the new year, like, man, you know, January 1st, I'm going to present myself to the Fulton YMCA and be like, it's happening this year. You know, I just need to push aside the holiday eating and also the fall eating and the summer eating and the spring eating and actually last January's eating as well. All of that for me, you know, was something I regret in many ways. And so I kind of look in the future. But what I'm not doing in those moments is I'm not celebrating what God has done. I'm not very good at looking back on the last year and finding the great stuff that he's done, the good things, the powerful things, the amazing things, the things that only he could do in my life. I don't do that enough. I don't do that often enough. In fact, at birthday parties, you know, one of the things we've tried to do with our friends over the years, just to sort of seize the moment and be fully present and fully engaged with people, is to kind of have everyone, you know, take the poor birthday girl or boy, whoever it is, and kind of put them in the middle of the room in a chair, which scares the life out of them, and it should probably. And they're sitting there, and then we do this thing called L&I time, where we tell them what we love about them and how they've impacted us. And it's maybe one little way to sort of let people know that they matter to us and that they're making a difference and their life is having an impact. But I don't do that enough. I don't do enough celebrating. I don't recognize. In fact, I'm wired to the point where when one thing is accomplished, there's actually a kind of a sadness that comes over me. Because so much effort's gone into completing this task. So whether it was completing my basement in April of 2005 and being, man, like, wow, here it is. Everything I drew up on paper, it's all done because my friends did all the work and I kept them fed and I kept running to Home Depot and kept the music good and, you know, just sort of was a part of it and worked, you know, with the extent of my skill set. But I remember looking around and being like, wow, it's done. And you would think that in that moment, a sense of accomplishment would rush over me and I'd celebrate. But instead, it was like this, now what do I do with all of my free time? Now what do I do with my dreaming and sketching and thinking through things? I'm not really good at celebrating what has been done. I'm not really good at taking time out to look back and be like, wow, God, look at what you've done here. In the story of Nehemiah, we've walked through this series called Ruined. And for those of you who haven't been here for a lot of it, or maybe it's your first Sunday here, the idea is that the city of Jerusalem was in ruins. And God called this man named Nehemiah to come back, leave his position as a cupbearer to the king of Persia, come back to Jerusalem and rally the people to rebuild the wall, which they did in 52 days in spite of incredible opposition, in spite of incredible hardship. They got the job done. Well, after they rebuilt the wall, then the people were like, you know, read to us from the Bible. We want to return to God spiritually. And so Ezra started reading to them the Bible from a high up platform. And he read to them, and then their hearts were broken because they saw how far they had wandered from God, and they were weeping. And Nehemiah and Ezra said, stop crying. Go home and party. Go home and celebrate. Go home and have fun. Go home and just rejoice in what God has done for you. It's not the time yet to weep. It's time to take a step back and look at all that God has done. And so then last week we looked at the people after they celebrated, after they feasted, then they swore a solemn oath. They made a new covenant with God that promised their hearts were returning to him. They promised that they would not wander away again, that they would respect God's laws, that they would honor his system, and that they would worship in the temple, and they would give sacrificially to the work of the Levites and the priests and the temple singers and the gatekeepers and all of those involved in that system. And the last verse summarized it and said, we will not neglect the house of our God. They made that promise to God. So now in chapter 11, we've got a very interesting situation that's arisen. We've got all these people, the walls have now been rebuilt, the temple's rebuilt, but the houses aren't rebuilt. Very few people were living in the city of Jerusalem, and this is not, you know, an accurate photograph of what Jerusalem would have looked like back then, but you look at that now, and if I'm like, let's go move into that city, you know, you're like, well, I've got children, and I don't want to be attacked by wild dogs in the night. And there's no, you know, like, it's just a scary place to be. The houses were in rubbles and ruins. So in chapter 11, verse 1, Nehemiah sees this, and he's like, we've got to have people move into the city. If this city's going to have a chance, it can't be desolate. When people move into a city, they rebuild it, and they grow it, and they restore it. So Nehemiah 11, verse 1 says, now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. So the leaders are there. The leaders have moved back in. How critical would that have been if Nehemiah was living in the Valley of Ono and he was like, well, everyone else should move into the city, but I'm going to hang out here in this special place that I want to live in. No, it says the leaders were there. So step one is getting your leadership to buy into that vision, and they're in there. And it says, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. So obviously this was not a very popular choice to make at that point. They had to reach almost the level where, so you take 10 families and you almost create a lottery system, use the casting of lots, which is something that's used a lot of times in the Bible, to determine which of the 10 families is going to move into the city. This is what they had to do to get people to move in. So look what's next. It says, verse 2, and the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. So even when your name was picked in that moment, it's like, okay, will you do it? And they're like, yes, we're going to go. Our family, the Johnson family, is going to move into the city. Pray for us because we are going to start from scratch. In a weird way, I don't know about you guys, but you know, it's kind of a pioneer picture. When I got the picture of pioneers, I'm picturing wagons heading out west, settling uncharted territories. But this is a very real picture of a pioneer going back into a city to rebuild it from the ground up. So they were looking for the pioneer spirits who would move back into the city and restore and rebuild. A few years ago, when God had laid on our hearts to be involved in a church plant in the city of Detroit, one major part of the vision was that anyone who was going to be a part of it with us would need to pray about moving into the city with us. Because there were 4,000 churches in the city of Detroit, which is crazy. 4,000. One of its nicknames, besides Motor City and some of the other ones, was City of Churches. Not many people call that anymore, but that used to be it. But what we learned was a lot of the pastors of these churches lived in the suburbs. They drove in on Sundays to minister to the people, but they drove back out to the safety of the suburbs because the city, in some parts, was truly dangerous. So when we started on this whole track, we felt God calling us into the city as well as to the people and as well as to pastor a church. And what's amazing is once we did sell our house in the suburbs and move into the city, I promise you the first question I got after what my name is and what I did for a living was, what's your name? My name's Cliff. What are you doing in the city? Oh, I'm starting a church. I'm pastoring a church. The next question was always, oh yeah, that's great. Where do you live? And for people who lived in the city, that was their litmus test. Because there were so many that weren't. And when I said, oh yeah, my family and I moved to Midtown, we live above the Starbucks, and they're like, oh, you live in the city? Then all of a sudden it just opened the floodgates for conversation. They wanted to hear about the church. They wanted to understand it. Like, wait, you're moving into the city everyone's moving out of. So there's something to that. There's something to that picture of being willing to move into that city, move into that area that God's called them to. So here we've got that situation where 1 out of 10 is being willing to then move into the city where Nehemiah and the other leaders already were. So this is, it's interesting, even as we walk through the spiritual importance of this book, we also see just from the perspective of city planning and building how important it is. You have to have some pioneers to be willing to be a part of the revival of that urban center in order for it to take hold. So Nehemiah is great at building lists, and so he puts together a big list of all the families and all the people that decided to move into the city. Isn't that amazing to think about that their name is forever in Scripture? So if the Overtons had decided to do this, their names would be in Scripture with their children. It would be forever in there. You know, it's just amazing to think, like, because of their willingness to follow God, that we're going to read their names for all time. So he put a big list together of those who moved back into the city. And then in chapter 12, so that kind of spreads a lot of ground there. And then chapter 12, verse 27, we move into Nehemiah's desire to dedicate the wall. So the wall is up. It's been built now for a while, but now Nehemiah wants to have a proper dedication. So listen to what he says in verse 27. At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, with thanksgiving and with singing, with cymbals, harps, and lyres. So look at the beginning of that verse. And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites in all their places. So remember, the Levites had scattered at this point. They weren't being cared for. They weren't in leadership roles. They were kind of just all over the place. And so in order to have this big dedication, in order to have this big feast, and to have this big service, they said, find me the Levites. Go find them. So for some of you, it brings to mind a film from late 70s, early 80s, the Blues Brothers. We're putting the band back together. If you've seen it late night on TBS, on all the time. But they go back and they find, like, oh, the best bass player in the world is a short order cook. And, oh, my goodness, the best trumpet player is now, you know, a hitman for this thing. And, you know, you find these guys all over the place and you bring them back. I love it. They sought the Levites in all of their places. So they're finding out, oh, my goodness, Joseph is the best harp player in all of the nation. But he's got a deli now that he's running in the Valley of Ono. We got to go find him. That deli's exploding. Okay, and they find him, like, hey, will you come and play your harp? Fine, okay. And he throws the apron down, a grand moment, and comes back. So they go out and they seek the Levites. Why was it important that they find the Levites? Why was it important that they find these musicians? Because they wanted this to be a celebration. They wanted it to be rejoicing. They wanted it to be a big dedication worthy of God. And so they needed the artists. They needed the musicians to come back. It's amazing that the movement of God sought artists and creatives and musicians to be a part of the big moment. But that's true, isn't it? You think about celebrations. You think about moments. We don't have to be told by people that when the team wins the big, they win the big game. And you know, I just remember 1996, Yankees game 6, World Series. I was in the stadium. Charlie Hayes floats into foul ground, makes the final out. John Wetland's on the mound. He jumps in the air and screams and parties and everything. And immediately the music starts and the whole stadium, we just cheer. I can't even imagine how far away they heard that cheer in New York. First World Championship in 18 years. But I was there, and I just remember throwing my hands up and be like, yes! And then all of a sudden, it was like I was just being carried along by this whole crowd. I was crowd surfing unintentionally. I was being victimized by the crowd surfing. And I looked back, and my friends were like 50 feet away from me, and we're all just cheering and celebrating. There's something inside of us. It's like, oh, of course you turn the music on. It's part of the celebration. We don't. If you ever go to a party where there's no music, what is it? That's not really that much. It's like, man, I guess I got to go. Honey, we just got here. I know, and it's time for us to leave. Music, that stuff, it's like the soundtrack of our celebration. It's something that we put to it, and it's written on our hearts. Can you even imagine a worship service on a Sunday morning with no element of music in it? If it was just a lecture. Boy, that's college, right? Or that's school again. It's like, man, we're not really in a hurry to get back to that place. It's dry. But boy, what if your history of the world civilization professor broke into some sort of a rap to tell you about the Roman Empire? I guarantee you would never forget it, and I'm not going to do that this morning, I promise. I remember things. Did anyone else do this? And maybe I'm alone, and I've come to terms with that in many ways. But did anyone else write fake songs to remember things for tests? Okay, there's a few sheepish hands going up. All right, good, good. I still remember some of those songs. I will not sing them for you. I still remember some of them and some of the weird, just boring facts that are attached to them. Why? You know, we've already talked about sort of the auditory learning, the learning you hear, less than 10% retention. We've talked about that. But yet, have you ever been walking through a department store and on comes that song that you heard when you were a kid and it's like, this song? I was 9 years old at my grandparents' house and there was a fire on and I was drinking hot cocoa and grandpa was wearing his reindeer sweater and you're like back in the moment somehow. And they're like, yeah, you couldn't remember to put the patio furniture away last week and yet you remember that? Sweet mercy. There's a disconnect. I'm like, well, you should have sung it to me and then I would never forget. Get rid of the patio furniture. I don't know what song that would be, but anyway. You look at that and it's like, my goodness, there's something about music that just, it's like it bypasses all of these traps and filters in our mind and it just gets right to our heart. How does a 30-second commercial make you cry? How is that even possible? I can get up here and tell you for an hour about the most incredible, and some of you will be like, others of you are like, are you done, bro? But man, Hallmark, my goodness, what is the deal? 30 seconds and you're sobbing. And they're like, come buy our cards. We charge a lot, but it's worth it. No, it's not worth it. There's something about art. There's something about music. There's something about all of that. The church, the movement of Jesus Christ to move forward. It's amazing to see those who can add meaning, who can add artistry, who can add beauty and creativity to God's word and to God's truth that makes us remember it and enter it in a different way. The movement of God needs artists. It's true today, just like it was true then. We need sculptors. We need painters. We need actors and musicians, photographers, dancers. First, I thought it said dangers. I'm like, I don't know where that word came from. It's dancers. That's why. Dancers. I can't read my own writing half the time. Writers, filmmakers, songwriters, poets, craftsmen, and singers. Can you even imagine the movement of God in this world without the artists? Nehemiah got that. He said, bring me the Levites. Bring me the best lyre players. Lyre was a term of endearment. It was an instrument, not an insult back then. Lyre players, harp players, tambourine, cymbals. Bring the band back. I need the best singers. This needs to be the best for God. We need to offer God our best. It helps us express to God our thanks and worship through creativity and beauty. And it sticks with us. No one hums lectures. But boy, we hum that song we heard this morning that we really liked. It sticks with you in a different way. So Nehemiah says, bring me the artists, bring me the Levites. So we move to verse 31. They find them all, and here's where it starts. This is Nehemiah talking. He says, then I brought the leaders of Judah up onto the wall and appointed two great choirs that give thanks. Now remember, the wall was very wide, so don't picture my chain link fence in the backyard trying to do this. They would have to then not only seek the Levites, but also the acrobats to do that. So we just have, it's a little wider here, it's about 8 feet wide, and Nehemiah breaks the group into two choirs. One group goes south, one group goes north, and they're walking along the wall. Listen to how they walk here. One went to the south on the wall to the dung gate. I would not have wanted that assignment. Wait, we're going where? Okay, Nehemiah, you're sending us to the dung gate. Thanks, man. You're going a different way, aren't you? Yeah, I knew you would. So Nehemiah is going a different direction. Look at verse 38. It says, the other choir of those who gave thanks went to the north, or away from the dung gate, and I followed them with half of the people on the wall above the tower of the ovens, to the broad wall, and above the gate of Ephraim, and by the gate of Yeshana, and by the fish gate, and the tower of Hananel, and the tower of the hundred, to the sheep gate, and they came to a halt at the gate of the guard. So both choirs of those who gave thanks stood in the house of God, and I and half of the officials with me. And the priests, Eliakim, Maaseiah, Miniam, Micaiah, Elioenai, Zechariah, and Hananiah with trumpets, and Messiah, Shemaiah, Eliezer, Uzi. So things got dangerous, he was there to control the crowd. Jehohanan, Micaiah, Elam, and Ezer. And the singers sang with Jezrahiah as their leader. How'd you like that? The worship leader is forever remembered for being the song leader. I love that. Verse 43, and they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. And the women and children also rejoiced. Let's read that again. And they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. Isn't that interesting? God made them rejoice with great joy. God had caused them to have this joy. Now, it's using the word joy a lot. And I think joy is an interesting term because a lot of times we want to talk about happiness. But happiness is different. Happiness is kind of like, oh my goodness, I had the best sandwich ever. It made me so happy to eat that salami on rye. It was glorious. But then all of a sudden later in the day when that doesn't agree with you, you're not so happy anymore when you're like, oh, that salami on rye is not doing great things to me. Happiness is temporal. It's sort of influenced by external circumstances. It can change very quickly. And so that way when people are giving their lives to the pursuit of happiness, that's a pursuit that looks kind of like this, doesn't it? It's like, oh, I want to grab. It's why you have these pro athletes that are like, I was at the top of the mountain and held on to that Lombardi trophy, and I was so happy. And then I came back to my hotel room and was like, so that's it? That's it. That's what I've lived my whole life for. Happiness is fleeting and very easily influenced by other. Now, it's not that we don't want to be happy. For sure. Is happiness part of joy? Absolutely. But joy is deeper. Joy is truer. Joy is a few levels down. Joy is something that can be chosen. It's hard. You ever hear someone be like, these horrible things happen, but I'm choosing to be happy? I'm choosing to be happy. It doesn't ring true. You're like, you just feel like, you feel bad for them. Like, how are you choosing to be happy in the midst of that? But when someone says that horrible things have happened, but they're choosing joy, there's something deeper in that. There's something they're drawing upon. In fact, earlier in Nehemiah, in chapter 8, when Nehemiah and Ezra told the people to quit crying, quit mourning, quit weeping, and to go home and celebrate, he says, the joy of the Lord is your strength. Not the fear of the Lord, but the joy of the Lord, the actual deep down, unmovable, unconditional joy that's at the heart of any believer. It's there. It can be chosen. It can be lived through. It's everlasting. It's eternal. It is not at all temporal. So you think of this moment. Put yourself in the shoes of this gathering. So we've got the two choirs. They've met now in the outer courts of the temple. They've taken their little prayer singing walk along the temple, and they've made it, and they've all sort of arrived in the middle of the temple court now. And we know it's the outer courts because women and children are mentioned. They wouldn't have been allowed in the inner courts. So they're all gathered, packed in there in the outer courts, and Jezrahiah is leading them in singing. And it says they rejoiced with great joy. They were so excited to worship God that way. I love this idea. To rejoice is to worship God for who he is, for what he has done, and for what he is going to do. To rejoice is to worship God for who he is, for what he has done, and also for what we believe he is going to do. The rejoicing out of that place, that's a deep place. That's a deep place of joy to say, God, for who you are, we rejoice. We worship you. For what you've done, we worship you. We rejoice. And for what you're going to do, we trust you, and we celebrate what you are going to do. You think of this crowd. What has this group gone through? Think about this. They were born into exile. They were born into slavery. They were born not free. Then God moved in the heart of the king, who then said, you can go back home. And 50,000 of the displaced, exiled Israelites returned home to the area surrounding Jerusalem, and some even to Jerusalem. And now in the last 15 years, not only have they been led out of captivity, but the temple has been rebuilt under the leadership of Zerubbabel. And then under the leadership of Nehemiah, the city wall has been rebuilt. And then under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, and from themselves, they've made a new covenant with God, restoring their right place with him and making him promises that they weren't going to wander again. Do you think they had some things to rejoice about in this moment? But again, they took a step back, because what if they just focused on what was around them? When they walked around the city walls, they're going to see rubble and ruin. Rubble, broken down houses, ruined houses. They're walking through, they're looking around. But you know what? Their eyes are up and they're saying, God, you have built this wall, you have built this temple, you've brought us out of captivity, and you've got a future for us. They could have still been discouraged by what they saw. They could have still been sad. What if you were one of the 10 who was drawn by lots to move your family and you're like, well, kids, there's our house. They're like, Dad, all I see is a big pile of rubble. Well, that's your room, Jimmy. They could have still been discouraged, but they're choosing joy in the midst of their surroundings. So what was it about this moment that they could celebrate? They could rejoice that they were redeemed and set free. God bought them back out of slavery. They were returned to their true home, a place that many of them had never been. The temple and the walls had been rebuilt, and their relationship with God had now been restored. What a powerful picture. In fact, for them, you know those verses that we love to quote? Jeremiah 29, 11 through 13, those are life verses to many of us. This was written, this was prophesied by Jeremiah to the exiles. This was something that was said, in the future you got to know, here's what God is saying to you. Imagine being the people that are living to see the fulfillment of Jeremiah 29, 11 through 13, which says, for I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans that give you a hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. And I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I've driven you, declares the Lord. And I will bring you back to the place which I sent you into exile. They are living in the promise of that. They're standing there together saying, that is true. God knew his plans for us, even when we were in slavery. God knew that this was coming, and we have the privilege of standing here as a family and worshiping God and thanking him for that. It's an incredibly powerful picture of rejoicing at what God has done. I'm not very good at doing this. When one thing is done, I'm like, okay, that's done now. Let's catch our breath. Let's take a few days off. Let's sleep. Let's play some FIFA 15 on PS4. Let's take a vacation. Let's calm down. Okay, now, what's next? But I feel like when you live that way, when I live that way, I'm missing a big piece. And I feel like the piece that I'm missing is really the antidote to pride. Because when you rejoice in what God has done, you are saying it's not me, it's him. When you don't rejoice in what God has done, it's very easy for others to say it was something that you did and for you not to disagree. So that is a very important piece. And when I think of my own life, I think of, my goodness, I look at the things I have to rejoice about. Do I have things to complain about? Sure, we all do. We all have things in our life that are hard. We all have things we wish were different. We all have preferences that aren't being met. We all have expectations that aren't being met. We all have people letting us down. But boy, if we take a step back, rather than focusing on our temporal happiness and say, but what do I have to be joyful about? And I could say I was chosen by God, loved by God, given salvation in Jesus Christ. I've been given new life in his name. All of us who are Christians in Jesus Christ, believers in Jesus Christ, we have been redeemed. We have been returned home. We've been bought out of slavery and given new life and freedom. We've been brought home and restored and rebuilt. We've been restored to the relationship that we once had with God in the garden before sin. Through Jesus Christ, now we have relationship with him again. So because of that redemption, rebuilding, restoration, we can now rejoice. That's something I could take joy in, that in my identity, that is true of me. I could rejoice in the family that God has given me, a wife that I love desperately, and children that I love and adore. I should not have looked at you when I said that. I'm pointing to Angela. If you're like, what, me? I can walk, I can talk. I have shelter. God has put a calling on my life, a purpose to do something I love to do, something I would die for, and someone that I get to live for. I'm in a community at this church, a community of believers that love and accept me for who I am, I think. Don't tell me anything else. I'm taking joy in that. It'll make me unhappy, but that's temporal. I have a community and a network of friends that have walked with me through a lot of hard things. I have a lot to rejoice in. I have a lot to look past and to see the core of what God has given to me. But I'm not very good at celebrating. I'm not very good at partying about this stuff. And I'm missing moments to do that. What do we have to think about as a church? What do we have to be joyful about as a church? I'm not only not good at this as a person, I'm not really good at this as a pastor either. God has done incredible things here. God is moving in a powerful way. We are seeing lives transformed. We're seeing marriages healed. We're seeing people come to faith in Jesus Christ for the first time. We're seeing people return to Jesus after years away. And it's not me. It's God. We need to rejoice that God is choosing to do something that we can't explain here. And then this summer, this little thing came up, like 33 days of manual labor that was funded, worked on, carried out, and completed by us. We didn't even do it in 52 days. We started the work on August 4th, I believe, and it was completed by September 7th at 1 a.m., the day of our kickoff, as Dave and I were scampering around in the lobby throwing flowers out and couches and things. We need to celebrate what God has done. We need to rejoice together. We are living in a season where God is choosing to pour something out here that cannot be explained or even understood. And I've not done a good job of doing that. We've not even had any sort of official dedication or anything. So how do we do that?